Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Who's in Charge Here, Part 2 Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 28, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Free Enterprise Fund versus Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. The question in this case was whether provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which established the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, violate the Separation of Powers Doctrine, the Appointments Clause, or both. In a 5-4 opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court, among other things, held that 1. The dual four-cause limitations on the removal of public company accounting oversight board members contravene the Constitution's vesting of the executive power in the president. 2. The removal provisions are severable from the rest of the statute. And 3. The board's appointment is consistent with the Appointments Clause. To discuss the case, we have Northwestern University George C. Dix Professor of Law Stephen G. Calabresi. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Calabresi.
This podcast concerns Free Enterprise Fund and Beckstead & Watts, LLP petitioners, against the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, hereinafter referred to as the PCAOB. This is a 5-4 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court issued on the last day of the term, the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, and it is the most important separation of powers opinion that the Supreme Court has issued in the last 22 years. This is certainly the most important opinion since Morrison against Olson in 1988. The majority opinion is very characteristic of Chief Justice Roberts. It is well written, tightly organized, no broader than it needs to be to decide the case, but very forceful in terms of the issues that are discussed. In summing up the case, I would say that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Free Enterprise Fund is best thought of as being, for the unitary executive, a little bit like what United States against Lopez was for the Commerce Clause. That is to say, it's a victory for the unitary executive. It's an important victory. It opens the door, potentially, to the unitary executive being adopted in other contexts, but it only decides the facts that are before it and whether it in fact will herald a reinvigoration of separation of powers case law or whether it will be simply a blip on the horizon is as yet undetermined. That depends appropriately on future cases. In describing the difference between Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion and Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent, it is best to begin by saying that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion is a classically formalist separation of powers opinion, like the majority opinion, for example, in INS against Jada, whereas Justice Breyer's dissent is a characteristically functionalist separation of powers opinion. And I will elaborate on what I mean by each of those points as I continue below. In looking at Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion, I think there are 5 major points that should be noted about his opinion. The first point is that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Free Enterprise Fund makes it very clear that the vesting clause of Article 2, the clause that says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, makes it very clear that that clause is a grant to the president of the executive power, which includes, in many contexts, the power to remove subordinate officers. Chief Justice Roberts' opinion is the first really clear holding of the Supreme Court that the vesting clause of Article 2 is a grant of power. There is language that implies as much in Myers against United States, Chief Justice William Howard Taft's landmark separation of powers opinion, but the Free Enterprise Fund case is really much clearer in recognizing the vesting clause as being a power grant. This is important because some have debated whether the removal power flowed from the vesting clause of Article II or from the take care clause of Article II. Chief Justice Roberts appropriately says that the take care clause confirms the granted power coming from the vesting clause. Second, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Free Enterprise Fund is important because the court's prior cases before Free Enterprise Fund were somewhat divided on the question of removal power. Myers against United States decided in 1926, a landmark opinion, as Chief Justice Roberts calls it in Free Enterprise Fund, had said that the president always enjoyed removal power, but three subsequent cases had narrowed Myers, and it wasn't clear until Free Enterprise Fund whether Myers was the norm or whether the subsequent cases narrowing it were the norm. The subsequent cases that narrowed Myers and that upheld limits on the removal power were Humphrey's executor, Wiener against United States, and United States against Morrison. The Free Enterprise Fund case makes it clear that the rule of Myers against United States of presidential removal power is the norm, and that Humphrey's executor and Morrison are an exception. So for that purpose alone, the Free Enterprise Fund case is tremendously significant. Roberts' opinion calls Myers a landmark case and clearly treats it as being the prevailing rule, with Humphrey's executor being an exception. Even the dissenters in Free Enterprise Fund concede that the Myers principle of presidential removal will apply perhaps half the time or much of the time to the executive branch. A third feature of Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Free Enterprise Fund that is important is that he holds on behalf of the court that it is not possible to set up an independent agency within an independent agency. And to explain this, I need to say a little bit about the facts of the case and what was at issue in the case. Free Enterprise Fund involved the constitutionality of a provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley law regulating the accounting industry, which set up within the Securities and Exchange Commission an entity called the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, or the PCAOB. The PCAOB was given very broad power to regulate the accounting industry, to adopt rules governing accounting, to bring enforcement actions concerning accounting matters, and to hear those enforcement proceedings. The PCAOB was therefore a full-fledged independent agency. The members of the PCAOB are appointed by the commissioners of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they are subject to removal by the commission only for cause, not at will. The SEC has been assumed to be an independent agency for a number of years now, although it's not in fact really clear that it is an independent agency. And so the case, as it reached the Supreme Court, presented the issue of whether Congress could create an independent agency nested within another independent agency. In other words, could Congress create an entity that was independent of the SEC when the SEC was in turn conceded by the parties to be independent of the president? The president's control over the PCAOB would thus be filtered through two layers of independence instead of one layer of independence. Chief Justice Roberts, on behalf of five justices, said that this was unconstitutional. Chief Justice Roberts' position was that one couldn't create double-layer insulation and that it is impermissible to insulate decisions made by an important law enforcement entity from the president to that degree. In saying this, he assumes, along with the parties, that the Securities and Exchange Commission is an independent agency. even though there may be some reason to doubt that, and even though the court might reconsider that conclusion in another case. Chief Justice Roberts, because he concludes that the PCOB protection of independence is unconstitutional, he's then thus faced with the issue of whether to rule on behalf of the petitioners and strike down the Sarbanes-Oxley Act as unconstitutional. Roberts declines to do that and instead severs the removal provisions that make the PCAOB independent so that henceforth the SEC can remove PCAOB members at will rather than only for cause. In all other respects, Sarbanes-Oxley remains viable and constitutional, and the PCAOB is constitutional in every respect except that its members are now removable at will by the SEC. A fourth major decision of the court in the PCOB case, aside from the fact that the statute violated presidential removal power guarantees flowing from the vesting clause of Article II, concerned various appointments clause questions. The Supreme Court held, in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, that PCAOB commissioners could be appointed by Securities and Exchange Commission commissioners on the ground that they are inferior rather than principal officers for purposes of the Constitution. The Constitution sets up two different kinds of federal officers: principal officers, who are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, and inferior officers, who may be appointed if Congress vests the power to appoint them in the president, the heads of departments, or the courts of law. The Supreme Court has had two tests in the past for determining whether an officer is an inferior officer or a superior officer, a principal officer. The court in Morrison against Olson said that the line between principal and inferior officers depended on how important the officer was. And the court in Morrison against Olson concluded that independent counsels didn't need to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate because they weren't that important. Justice Scalia dissented in Morrison against Olson and wrote a different opinion some years later in Edmund against United States, where he said that the test for determining whether an officer is an inferior officer is whether that officer has a boss or a supervisor. The Supreme Court concluded that PCAOB commissioners were inferior officers because, with the removal provision excised, the Securities and Exchange Commission could meaningfully supervise them, and they did have a boss and an officer. Doctrinally, the significance of PCOB on the inferior officers question is that it writes Justice Scalia's opinion in Edmund against United States and his dissent in Morrison against Olson on the Appointments Clause issue into law, and says that that is the Scalia test for officer inferiority is the test that governs. Fifth, the court, in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, reached several additional Appointments Clause questions. Having concluded that PCAOB members were inferior officers, it was necessary for the court to determine whether Congress had vested their appointment in the president, the heads of departments, or the courts of law. Obviously, PCAOB commissioners are not appointed by the president or the courts of law, so the court therefore focused on the question of whether the Securities and Exchange Commission can be characterized as the head of a department which can be a recipient of the inferior officer appointment power under the Constitution. Chief Justice Roberts concluded that the SEC is a department, that commissions, independent regulatory commissions, are departments, which seems almost certainly correct. And he also concluded that the multi-member commission is the head of a department rather than the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission being the head of a department. This is, in my view, a more strained interpretation, and I think this is the one aspect of the court's opinion that I'm not persuaded by. But Chief Justice Roberts, in concluding this, was clearly validating the practices of all the many multi-member commissions that appoint inferior officers that are part of the administrative state. In holding that the SEC is a department and that the commission is the head of a department, Chief Justice Roberts wrote into law a concurrence which Justice Scalia had written in a case called Freytag, which Roberts had argued to the Supreme Court when he was an assistant in the Solicitor General's office. In short, Roberts' opinion is a landmark opinion both on the scope of the removal power and with respect to the appointments clause. It is a tremendously important opinion. It is a formalist opinion in that it is premised on asking what kind of power does the PCAOB exercise. The answer is executive power, and Roberts concludes, under this court's precedence, executive power can only be vested in entities that are insulated by one layer of removal from the president, not by two layers. Justice Stephen Breyer's dissent is also an extremely important separation of powers opinion, although it comes out the other way. Justice Breyer's dissent argues that there are two competing principles with respect to agency independence, and that half the time the vesting clause of Article II governs and officials should be presidentially removable, but in some other set of circumstances, the necessary and proper clause, in Breyer's view, allows Congress to create independent entities within the executive branch. Breyer explains that the test which determines whether independence can be created or not is one that depends on the function that the entity is performing. Where entities are performing quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative functions as well as quasi-executive functions, there, he thinks, agency independence is permissible. Justice Breyer's dissent echoes the importance of functionalism in the scholarship of Professor Peter Strauss at Columbia Law School. The most important complaint in Justice Breyer's dissent is that he argues that under the majority's opinion, there are scores and scores of officials protected by the civil service laws who report to commissions that are themselves independent. And Breyer argues that those officials are just as insulated by a double layer of independence from presidential removal as are the PCAOB commissioners. Breyer thus argues that if the court takes seriously what it says in Free Enterprise Fund against PCAOB, that scores of civil service positions will be rendered unconstitutional. Breyer, for example, notes that administrative law judges are only removable for cause and that they, in turn, report to many independent agencies, the commissioners of which are removable only for cause. And Justice Breyer asks whether henceforth all administrative law judges will be challenged when they try to decide a case as to whether their appointments are valid because under PCAOB they are protected by double independence rather than single independence from the president. Breyer's point is a good one, and it is certainly possible to give Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion in this case that broad a reading. It is also possible to confine Chief Justice Roberts' case just to the very peculiar facts of the PCAOB, which looked very much like an independent agency nested within an independent agency. Whether Roberts' opinion is a glass half full or a glass half empty for purposes of the unitary executive is essentially unanswerable. The opinion has language that could be read in both ways. My own view is that Roberts thinks that the unitary executive is the general principle and that this is an opening wedge, the way Lopez was an opening wedge toward a revival of separation of powers formalism. But Roberts quite properly decides no more than he needs to decide this particular case, and whether Justice Anthony Kennedy will join Roberts in any further expansion of the unitary executive remains to be seen in future cases. This case is significant, finally, because a number of members of the court, since the Supreme Court had not decided a unitary executive removal power case since 1988, it was the case that only two members of the Supreme Court currently were also members of the Supreme Court when Morrison against Olson was decided in 1988. One of those members, Justice Scalia, in 1988 was on the unitary executive side. The other member, Justice John Paul Stevens, was on the independent agency anti-unitary executive side. Scalia and Stevens retained the same positions in the PCAOB case that they held in Morrison against Olson in 1988. But this time, Scalia picked up four allies, while Stevens picked up only three. And so a 7-1 majority in 1988 against the unitary executive became, in this case, a 5-4 majority in favor of it. Justice Clarence Thomas joined Chief Justice Roberts' opinion along with Justice Scalia, which isn't surprising given his writings on other executive power cases and issues. Chief Justice Roberts himself and Justice Alito, newly appointed to the Supreme Court, relatively speaking, also supported the opinion. And critically, Justice Anthony Kennedy, often described as a swing vote on the current Supreme Court, and who had not participated in the 1988 decision in Morrison against Olson, came out for the unitary executive here. On the other side, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, neither of whom had expressed themselves on the removal power issue, joined Justice Breyer's dissent. In sum, this is a very solid win for the theory of the unitary executive. Is again, to recap, it does confirm that Myers against United States is a landmark and that it is the general rule with respect to executive branch, presidential removal of executive branch officers. However, the court does not overrule any precedents in this case. It was not asked to do so by any of the parties, and so it declines to overrule any precedents. And the case is best thought of as doing for the unitary executive and a formalist conception of the separation of powers, something like what Lopez did for the Commerce Clause. It's an opening, it's a beginning, but where it will lead, nobody knows.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.